This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Very few correspondents have put as many miles on their shoes over the past couple election cycles as Tim Alberta, now chief political correspondent for Politico. He's worked for the National Review, the Wall Street Journal, and others, and his book, American Carnage, a New York Times bestseller, was one of the most widely read accounts of the 2016 election cycle and the rise of Donald Trump. He lives and works in Michigan. Tim Alberta, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
This little article you published in 2016 in the National Review, looking at the Michigan primaries results and modestly proposing, don't write off this real estate developer and reality TV star named Trump too soon. What was it like to be right?
Oh my gosh, I don't think I've ever been asked that, certainly not by my wife or any loved ones. What was it like to be right? You know, it's interesting because I can't, I will hang my hat on that one article, but like so many other people, I think there were other just fundamentally important things that I missed along the way in 2016. So I don't want to tip my, I don't want to puff out my chest too much.
Well, you said at the end of the article that you didn't think Trump would carry Michigan.
Close the deal.
Which turned out to be something he did by 10,000 votes.
By 10,000 votes, right. And really, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, those three by a combined 77,744 votes. I mean, that's the difference between a Clinton presidency and a Trump presidency. But, you know, looking at that one article you mentioned, yeah, I was right in just seeing how, you know, March 8th, 2016 was such an interesting day with that Michigan Republican primary that Trump won, with the Democratic primary that Sanders obviously won. And sort of if you took the maps, the result maps of those two primaries and sort of overlaid them on the November general election map, it was just uncanny how similar it was. And the dynamics you saw sort of driving those two primaries, and specifically on the Democratic side, looking at depressed turnout, looking at a lack of energy among African-American voters for Hillary Clinton, looking at her getting really demolished among independents and getting beaten badly among white working class voters in exurban and rural parts of the state, those were sort of flashing red lights for her campaign. And her campaign, you know, essentially refused to acknowledge them, not just in Michigan, but we saw them in other places. We saw it in Philadelphia, in the Philadelphia suburbs. We saw it in the city of Philadelphia itself. We saw it in Milwaukee and metropolitan Milwaukee. And obviously, we focus a lot on those three states, but we saw it in other places around the country as well. I think what was so clear walking out of that 2016 Democratic primary was not that Bernie Sanders was some force of nature, but that Hillary Clinton was a deeply flawed Democratic nominee in waiting, and that if she didn't do something dramatic to address those vulnerabilities, that she could lose a state like this. And obviously at the time, a lot of people sort of rolled their eyes at that. I don't think I've ever gotten so much hate mail after writing a piece. Everybody said, you must be crazy. There's just no way. It's part of the blue wall. Democrats haven't lost the state since 1988. But sure enough, she just didn't do enough to address those vulnerabilities. And Trump, you know, I think in many ways was sort of ideally positioned to exploit them.
You've come 4 years later right back around to the Michigan primary in a piece that came up this week, looking at Bernie Sanders and Michigan. And, you know, that 2016 primary victory, you point out that Bernie loyalists looked at what happened in the 2016 cycle with Bernie Sanders stealing Michigan away from Hillary Clinton, saying, Bernie's on fire. This is huge. And then more moderate party members looked at the exact same results and said, good Lord, turnout was low.
Mm-hmm. You know, we focused so much in the 2016 cycle on white working class voters and their disillusionment with the party. We focused a lot on African-American voters and how they just were not energized by a Hillary Clinton candidacy after 8 years of Barack Obama. The one group we didn't talk a lot about was wealthy, upscale suburbanites, and specifically suburban women, college-educated moms in Oakland County and in parts of Macomb and Livingston counties and on the west side of the state in Kent County. How are they voting? How are they responding? And if the 2018 midterm elections were any indicator, the Democratic Party in Michigan has a real reason to feel hopeful because, you know, what you saw with the victories of Gretchen Whitmer as governor, Alyssa Slotkin in the 8th District, Haley Stevens in the 11th District, those were victories that really came in no small part on the strength of a big spike in voting and in turnout among those suburban women in areas that have not been friendly to Democrats traditionally. And so if you continue to see that in 2020, and it's a big if, I mean, midterm voting behavior patterns are much different than general election behaviors. But if you see a sustained enthusiasm among those suburban, affluent, college-educated, two-car garage households, and particularly the moms there, then it's suddenly coalition, politics being a coalition business, it suddenly becomes very difficult to see how Donald Trump could overcome all of those demographics working against him.
All this soul searching that's been going on the Democratic side has really challenged the notion that the Democratic Party would have to rely on the same old voting blocks. You know, what if Bernie Sanders was right to an extent that the future lies with younger voters? You know, could it be that Latinos can be brought in around to a party's nominee eventually? Maybe the Democrats are thinking that they don't have to rely on the same old voters or older voters. Is the Republican Party even close to having a conversation like that right now?
Oh, the irony here is Shakespearean, because they were very close to having that conversation. In fact, they were having that conversation after the 2012 election. You know, when Barack Obama was reelected, Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee that year, he won just 17% of non-white voters. He won only 27% of Hispanic voters. And the demographic writing seemed to be on the wall for the GOP at that point. And what ensued was basically a year-long soul-searching process in which the party, in a very rare public way, sort of acknowledged its own vulnerabilities and its blind spots and frankly, some of its sort of more overtly xenophobic tendencies in driving away some of these voters. And it really seemed like the party, I mean, even people like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, some of the hardliners, were coming around to this idea that, you know, we cannot attempt to just win presidential elections on the backs of white voters. Like, the math doesn't work. And then Donald Trump comes along and blows
just
that
sweeps
up.
It
right?
away. People love to call it a fractious and protracted primary, but there was some stuff getting figured out there.
There was. Yeah, there was. And look, honestly, as counterintuitive as it may seem, parties traditionally, historically speaking, political parties tend to do their best work when they're in the minority, when they're out of power, because they sort of have the space and the time to figure some of that stuff out. Nobody's paying attention. And you can sort of tear it down and rebuild it, right? Just like a bad sports franchise, not that we have any of those in Michigan. and I think it's so important to recognize that, you know, Donald, I mentioned Shakespeare a minute ago. I mean, the guy who was heading up that whole project for the Republican Party was Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican Party. And he was the one saying to anybody who would listen, look, the math here doesn't work. We can't win elections this way. And then he becomes White House chief of staff to the guy who crumpled up that plan and threw it in a waste paper basket.
You detail all of this in American Carnage, this detailed story about how at first everybody in the GOP, most of the people in the GOP were considering Trump a joke, but ultimately they found his candidacy and his presidency extremely useful. Sure, you get the overt appeals to white nationalists, rejection of not just science, but certain accepted facts that the rest of Washington takes for granted. But you also get tax cuts and a hard line on social issues and maybe a wedge to blue collar voters through trade policies and all the judicial nominations that any conservative could hope for. Do you see the party ever getting to the point of deciding that this president causes more problems than he solves? Or is that deal just like still working out for them?
I think it's still working out for most of them. No question. And you know, I've had these conversations with Republican voters that range from, you know, sort of low income, low education levels, people who are living in sort of isolated rural areas and who really love the president, all the way to people who are, you know, millionaires and very wealthy and successful with multiple degrees on the wall. And the one thing that they will sort of tell you is, look, If you were to put on a blindfold and just sort of look at the accomplishments, forget about the Twitter feed, forget about the rhetoric, forget about a lot of the strange behavior, but if you were just to look at the results, and if you want to view politics and government as a results-oriented business, then these are pretty good, and we would take them, right? And that is, I think, the fundamental question for a lot of moderate Republicans, sort of center-right Republicans this November, because they do like the results. They do think the economy is doing better than it was 4 years ago. They do feel like a lot of the deregulatory measures and other things that the administration has done have contributed to not just an economy that's better, but to sort of a general sense of confidence in the country and among consumers and everything else, and they like that. And yet, there's this other thing. There's this elephant in the room. There's this cloud hanging over them, whatever bad cliche you want to use, where they feel like this isn't quite right. And
You mean the strange behavior and instability?
Yes.
Of the president.
Yeah. You know, and you'll talk to voters about, you know, the chance at rallies, that sort of play to some of that white nationalism, and the president's Twitter feed, which is seemingly creating crises where none necessarily exist. And that's the stuff that they're uncomfortable with. And socially, especially for those more upscale Republicans at the one end of the spectrum, you know, there's a bit of a sort of class consciousness involved in this, right? Like, you don't want to be a social pariah for saying that you still support this president.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Alberta. He's chief political correspondent for Politico and the author of American Carnage. I guess the real issue is whether the Democratic Party has an answer, as a counter to all those results coming out of primaries in Michigan and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And look, this is, I think, in so many ways, this Democratic primary was a really good proxy to figure out not just where the party is today, but where it's going to be over the, you know, sort of medium and long haul. Joe Biden, late in Michigan, said something very, very interesting. He was at Renaissance High School in Detroit, and he talked about being a bridge to the next generation of Democrats, which is an unusual thing for a potential nominee of a party to say.
I mean, it's acknowledging he's the old dude in the room.
That's exactly right. And not just the old dude in the room, but all, which he is, but also the guy who is not nearly as far to the left as some of the activists in his party's base are, and certainly not as far to the left as most of the other candidates in this race were. And he's saying, look, you know, this is a sort of trajectory that we're on here, but we're not going to get all the way there. I mean, Barack Obama used to talk about this all the time. And so Joe Biden, I've got to think, is emerging in about as strong a position as he could, given the fact that you just had this historically large primary field, given how divisive things were at various points in the campaign, given just how divided the party's base has been between the progressive wing and the more centrist sort of governing wing. Joe Biden has a chance here over the next week or two to really kind of put this thing away and become the de facto nominee. And for all of his manifest flaws as a candidate, and he does have plenty of them, I think Biden is probably the least threatening candidate to a lot of those voters, particularly those sort of center-right suburban voters that we've spent so much time talking about. And if you believe that that is the critical swing group here that could move en masse from one candidate to the other, then I think Joe Biden is a better candidate to reach them than Bernie Sanders is or Elizabeth Warren or any of these other Democrats.
You said something absolutely fascinating on Twitter not long ago, that no one should be allowed to cover the presidential race if they have not also covered Congress. I wanted not a 140-character tweet out of that, but about a 2,000-word piece. What did you learn from covering Washington that has served you well this year?
Yeah, and look, I think I probably irritated a lot of people by saying that. And there are lots of reporters who cover the presidential campaign who do just fine. I was sort of being hyperbolic to make a point, which is that we spend a lot of time in covering these campaigns talking in not just in hypotheticals, but in sort of ultra crazy hypotheticals about things that these people are talking about getting done. And the reality is, if you know Washington, and particularly if you know Congress and just how polarized and bitterly divided Congress has been in the post 9/11 era, then you understand that most of these things these folks are talking about are just completely unrealistic. They're not going to get done. I mean, the idea that you could pass a Medicare for all single payer healthcare system in this country, it just defies what we saw happen 10 years ago when Barack Obama had to pour every ounce of political capital he had over a period of 18 months into passing the Affordable Care Act, which was really a very moderate piece of healthcare legislation, something that incorporated a lot of traditional Republican ideas. And so the idea that just 10 years later, despite the fact that majorities of Democrats in both the House and Senate do not support Medicare for All. The idea that we're spending all of this time talking about how it's going to be paid for and what the legislative mechanics are, it's just, it's a little bit silly, and I think it probably does a disservice to voters because it leads them to believe, just like Mexico paying for the wall, that this is something that could actually happen when in fact we know that it can't.
You noted that Alyssa Slotkin and Haley Stevens wins really kind of paved the way for some of the cross currents in the race this year. These are both Democrats who ran right down the middle and managed to ride a wave of sort of protest against what's been going on in Washington to take over Republican seats. How do you like their chances this year?
Boy, it's such a great question. And I don't know if there are more interesting members of Congress in the country to watch than those two, in terms of sort of proxies for where the environment was in 18 and then where it will be in 2020. You know, Oakland County and Livingston County, these are just great places to test this theory that it's really these, you know, affluent suburban areas that are home to the new swing voter. I mean, for decades, we've talked about swing voters being the second shift worker up to his elbows in grease at the diner, and those people just really aren't swing voters
Reagan
anymore.
Democrats.
The Reagan Democrats, right, yeah. In Macomb County, and really the conversation now has to shift to Oakland and Livingston. These are the places to watch. And so, look, if Alyssa Slotkin and Haley Stevens can run perfect campaigns, then I think the sort of power of incumbency will give them a real chance to hold on to those seats. And I think the fact that the party looks, for all intents and purposes at this point, like it's going to nominate Joe Biden, I think that that is also helpful to them. I think it would have been very difficult for these women to thread the needle with a Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket. That being said, when turnout really juices up in a general election year, and especially in the case of Slotkin, this is somebody who does represent a district that is just fundamentally right of center. And so she's going to have some inherent headwinds in an environment like this.
Who knows what's going to happen in August, but I've got to wonder if the Republican Party, as it exists with Donald Trump at the head of the ticket, can produce a moderate candidate who could counter their constant efforts just to position themselves as apolitical at the center of everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, and look, what's so interesting is when you had this wave environment in 2018 where, and the funny thing is, if you talk to the average voter and you ask them, hey, how did Democrats take back the House in 2018? Was it on the strength of an unabashedly progressive message that resonated nationwide, talking about impeaching the president, talking about Medicare for All, talking about abolishing ICE, or was it one on the strength of a bunch of moderate Democratic candidates who basically, in many cases, sounded like moderate Republicans, talking about balancing the budget, talking in some cases about protecting gun rights, talking about wanting to restore bipartisanship to Washington? 8 out of 10 people you talk to on the street would say, oh, it was the first. It was the AOC crowd, the squad. And that's just not right. I mean, Democrats had such a great year because of what you said. They recruited all of these very disciplined candidates who ran right down the middle, and they were able to appeal to districts that are increasingly purple. The question is, can Republicans do the same thing? Will they be smart and disciplined enough to recognize that the best way to try and win those districts back is not to overreach, but to try and mimic, in part, some of those successful playbooks that were run by Democrats?
You are that rare and marvelous unicorn of a politics reporter whose writing relies less on polls and more on primary results and interviews. But at the same time, political polling firms have been swearing up, down, and sideways they've made improvements and that we may be able to trust what they have to say about the national campaigns this year. How do you decide whether to trust a poll?
You know, oh gosh, that's another great question. I will start with by prefacing that I don't trust most polls to begin with. So it's almost like, they don't have the benefit of the doubt. I will look at a lot of polling, and there are certain indicators I'll look for. So the first is going to be, well, and this is less of an indicator than just something you know if you live in this world, but the reputation of the pollster themselves and whether there's somebody who is sort of competent and diligent and really exhaustive in the work they do. But then you have to start with looking at the sample size. You know, there are polls that will come out that are taken of 250 or 300 or 400 voters, and that's just typically not a big enough sample size for you to really draw any meaningful conclusions from, especially when you start looking in the crosstabs trying to figure out how certain demographic groups are going to vote. If you've got a poll with a sample size of 350 and you want to know how suburban women with a college degree are voting and there's only, you know, 39 of them in the survey, that just doesn't help you at all. So what we saw in 2016 in Michigan and in Wisconsin, a little bit less in Pennsylvania, but there was still a problem there. It's not just that the polls were off, it's that they were wildly off. I mean, you had polling 2 weeks before the election in Michigan that showed Donald Trump polling at 33%, right? And I think the obvious conclusion for anybody with a brain who saw that was to say, well, this guy doesn't stand a chance, right? I mean, because that would just defy all history. We've never seen anybody with numbers like that even be competitive, much less win. And obviously, it was hard to quantify for pollsters just how unpopular both of these people were and how many voters were still undecided and how many voters might just stay home altogether. It's a long way of saying that pollsters have an incredibly difficult job, and I think it's valuable what they try to do. But now more than ever, I think folks in my profession really have to rely on a whole host of different metrics to sort of inform the way we report on this, not just look at the polling.
Preferably not involving landlines.
Yes, landlines are bad.
Tim, before you go, can you tell us about some of the places you've spent time since last fall that maybe were new to you or you thought were especially interesting?
Gosh, sure. Yeah, I can. Let's see. So I had a pretty memorable visit just recently to Columbus, Ohio. We were talking a bit about this before I came on the air, near and dear to your heart.
Well, that's a town that's changed so much. It has become the locus of political activity in the state as its population's ballooned above a million. And it's so much photograph of what's going on in both the Republican and the Democratic parties right now.
Absolutely. And we were talking a bit about this realignment, this grand realignment that's happening in the age of Trump. And yeah, Columbus gives you a nice window into that. I happen to be spending time there with a bunch of young Democratic socialists and trying to have some conversations with them about not just the Bernie Sanders campaign, but about, you know, their mission much more broadly. And it was really interesting to learn about how they see the world, how they see the economy, and what they're trying to do in their communities that really falls outside of the boundaries of electoral politics. You know, I've spent time in South Florida talking with Cuban voters about, and obviously there is a tendency at times to view the Hispanic voting population as a monolith, but voters in California who are of Latino descent are just so different than voters in South Florida of Latino descent. So that's a really interesting thing that you can really sink your teeth into as a reporter and dive into.
Cuban Americans have been a stalwart of the Florida Republican Party. How are they feeling about Donald Trump?
You know, so there's a former congressman, Carlos Curbelo, who was defeated in 2018, and he was one of these sort of shining stars, a guy with an incredibly bright future from South Florida, and he lost his seat in 2018. And he lost his seat because despite the fact that he was extremely popular in his district, he was 15 or 20 points above water in all of the polling that was done down there, Donald Trump was 15 or 20 points below water in all the polling and essentially washed it out and made him vulnerable, and he lost in a pretty close election. And I've talked to him a few times about this, and he said, look, at the end of the day, you know, there are a lot of folks in a community like the Cuban community who have real sort of core cultural and social values that Trump offends, right? And for them, what's difficult is that on the one hand, Trump sort of offends them and repels them and makes them wonder how they could ever support this guy. But then some of what they see come out of the Democratic Party, they almost feel like they are voters without a country, right? Men and women without a country. And what's interesting, coming back to completely beat this thing to death with the suburban women, is all over the country, April, for the last couple of years, including those 2018 midterms, I've been in dozens of states, in dozens of congressional districts, and it's the same thing over and over and over again. You'll hear talking to these voters that, gosh, I would love to find a compelling reason to vote against Donald Trump, but some of these Democrats just scare the life out of me. And you just wonder if ultimately when folks find themselves in the booth in 2018, whether Joe Biden will have given them sufficient confidence to go ahead and pull the lever for him, or whether they whether the Trump campaign does a really effective job of tying Biden to the rest of the Democratic Party and to some of those more progressive policies that that the vice president has sort of distanced himself from.
Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico, thank you so much for talking with us. And I can't wait to read what else you're working on this year.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.